This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. There is a growing push to get science out of the lab and into the public. Science cafe events are popping up in bars and public spaces around the country, and laboratories are increasingly calling on citizen scientists to contribute data and even analyze the results. My next guest is Holly Menninger. She is Director of Public Science for the College of Sciences at NC State, and she's made a career communicating scientific research with the public. She talks about the need for public input in science at the Periodic Table Science Cafe on Tuesday, January 10th at Motor Co. Music Hall in Durham. But first, she joins me on the State of Things. Welcome back. Good to have you on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us more about this, the Science Cafe. I mean, what are you trying to achieve here?
So science cafes are part of live events where the idea is you bring a scientist into a bar or a public space, an informal space. Scientists shares a little bit about their work, and then there's an opportunity afterwards for questions and dialogue. And it's a great opportunity, I think, to bring scientists out of their lab space into the public sphere and create a real opportunity for engagement. And they're popping up all over the place. We actually have three in the Triangle area. Periodic Tables is just one of those.
What is the impetus for this? Why the idea that scientists need to get out of their lab and talk to the folk?
I think increasingly there's a need for the public to not only understand science, but understand the process of science. And I think making that human connection with a scientist, having them interact face-to-face in a live space, is a really great way to connect on that interpersonal level.
Who shows up? I mean, I'm wondering if these are people who are sort of already bought in, or are there critics who say, you know, you're some kind of tyrannical elite group that's sort of pushing us around?
I have yet to meet a hostile audience at a science cafe. In the Triangle, I think we have a very science-friendly, science-interested audience, maybe if we went to a different part of the country. But really, the audiences are pretty diverse. They tend to be mostly adult, people who may be interested in science, or people who are looking just for an interesting social event where they might learn something. They range in age. I think I've seen everybody from teenagers through retired persons whose interest is piqued by the topic. Sometimes there's a series of regulars. I frequently go to the Science Cafe at the Museum of Natural Sciences downtown Raleigh, and there are some regulars, I think, that like to come because I think it's an opportunity for them to learn about new and interesting topics.
Is there a danger in all of this, though, that in the zeal and in the effort to kind of make it understandable and, applicable, that you... some of the complexity is lost, and maybe some of the truth in the science gets lost?
I think, you know, people, I've often talked to people about sort of, are we dumbing it down when we go into these public spaces? I think there's a way to communicate science that still maintains and helps communicate that process and maybe the complexities of the outcomes of science, but making it in a way that's accessible, that people can think about how science may affect their daily lives. They may think about how they interpret science news as it comes out sort of after going to that event. So I'm not really worried about that aspect of it.
That seems to me to be one of the greatest challenges. You know, when I was working at NPR, our science unit there was brilliant at making sure that the analysis and that the framework for how this science was done and what to take away and what not to take away, what these percentages mean and what they don't mean. And I think that's the hardest thing to communicate because it does get a little technical.
Yeah, it can be. And particularly the interpretation of results. I've done some research related to the microbiome, the collection of microorganisms living on and around us. And a colleague of mine at UC Davis has an award he calls Overselling the Microbiome, where he has a series of blog posts talking about headlines where people are looking for the next great cure for this disease. And so, I think a consequence of having more scientists out there in the public sphere having these dialogues is that we can discuss issues like that, help people interpret those nuances that relate to the science that's coming out.
You're also, as part of this, and not necessarily the cafes themselves, but as this greater push to engage the public in science, there is citizen science.
Yeah.
You're getting, so tell us about some of the projects you've got going right now that allow us all to participate.
Absolutely. So over the last few years, I've been deeply involved in citizen science, and that's what we call the field where the public participates directly in scientific research. And they can participate through the collection of data. They can participate through the analysis analysis of results. And I worked for many years with Rob Dunn in the Department of Applied Ecology at NC State. He had a program called Your Wildlife, and we were engaging the public and studying the biodiversity in their daily lives. And I'm still connected to several of those projects. One that we had is called The Wildlife of Our Homes, where we are trying to map the home microbiome. So what microorganisms live on common surfaces in our homes, and how might those microbes affect our health and well-being? So we had 1,400 participants across the country collect dust samples from their homes, both inside and outside, and we continue to analyze those samples. So most of those came in 2 to 3 years ago, and the data is still coming out. We had a recent paper that looked at what insects we could use the DNA that was located in the dust of those samples to understand the insect biodiversity inside people's homes.
So, is there anything about, is this a way in which to engage citizens? Which is kind of great. You all go swab mm-hmm. go dust under your bed and send it to us. But is there a way in which you're now getting more data than you might otherwise? Does it really help you as a scientist?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the major bonuses of citizen science is that it allows us to collect data at scales that we were not ever able to do as individuals. We would not, as scientists, have been able to go into 1,400 homes. It would have taken us years to do that. And so that scale, the sort of continental scale, has been really important. But it's also the citizen science has allowed us to go into spaces that scientists really haven't had access. So we had another project looking at
my armpit.
Yeah, your armpit, exactly. Camel crickets in the basements of people's homes. So these are these big, leggy, jumpy crickets that a lot of people have in this part of North Carolina. Turns out they're really common throughout eastern North America. And we didn't really know anything about their distribution or that they're actually not native to the U.S., that they're from Asia. And it was only with the help of citizen scientists who snapped pictures of those camel crickets, sent them to us, that we were able to identify and map the distribution of those camel crickets.
Because when you get them in the basement, they actually still have their passport.
Exactly. And they jump at you. They're very bold.
What now, is there a worry, though, that citizen scientists aren't trained the way professional scientists are, and that in collecting this data, it might be somehow compromised? You might not be getting good data.
I think that's a criticism that I've heard a lot. Fortunately, the scientists are on top of that. And so we've done a few studies to compare how well citizen scientists collect data and compare that against the experts, and it's a wash. I think that if you give citizen scientists really clear instructions, tell them what to do, and you're collecting a lot of data at one time, sort of any small errors will wash out. And citizen scientists, they really care. They're deeply committed to the process. They're excited to be scientists. They want to do a good job. And so that's no longer really a concern in my mind.
Once I send you my crickets and dust, there's a chance that I might want to be more involved in this. Is there a way that citizens are involved in the analysis or the follow-up?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the Wildlife of Our Homes project, we're no longer collecting swabs, the samples of dust. But because we have so much data, and it will probably take us 10 years to analyze all of it, we've shared a lot of that openly online. And so if people go to Rob Dunn's website, it's therobdunnlab.com, that they can get access to those data sets and use an online program called Finch, P-H-I-N-C-H, that allows them to visualize that data and probe it, looking for patterns in the biodiversity of microbes.
Right. So this is like the commons now. There's a way in which... Well, that leads to this next question, which is whether or not this kind of input and this way of doing things, opening up the academy mm-hmm. a little bit, has changed your ideas about how we do science. I mean, not just in terms of allowing people to send you samples, but the whole, some of the framework of scientific inquiry, does it change by allowing more people in and having these discussions?
I think so. It certainly has opened up my eyes to the sort of the approaches that we do science. I don't think when I started graduate school, I necessarily considered how the public might be able to be engaged. But I think the really exciting piece here is that there's an opportunity not just for the public to learn about science, but also for scientists to learn something too. And that's really the most exciting piece, thing in my mind about our whole approach that we call public science, connecting people to science and scientists, is that it's not just this one-way push of information yeah. that we're hoping to sort of change hearts and minds in that way, but that there's an opportunity for scientists to rethink a little bit about how they do what they do.
Well, I would think so, because again, if you're going to do well in college and postgraduate work, you're going to write that paper the way your professor wants it to be read. So you're going to ask the question the right way. You're going to frame the question and make sure that it's going to be worded in such a way. And I would guess that you might get the wording of a question in such a way that just completely allows you to see this question differently.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think, too, that I can think of a couple cases where questions from the public actually reshaped or influenced the next step in the scientific process. I think we come out of school, or at least, you know, early primary, elementary, and middle school, thinking that science is sort of the straight linear process of observation, hypothesis, experiment, you know, ultimately conclusions and theory. And I you know, the process of science is a little bit messy. It's a little bit convoluted. There's room for community input. There's room for creativity. There's room for serendipity. And so I think having public involvement makes that process even richer.
Now, I understand that some of the impetus behind this, too, is the fact that grants these days are really looking for a greater kind of application. In other words, what good is it going to do? And that was not always the case for scientific grants. That's changed a little bit. I mean, is that any part of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the National Science Foundation, which is a federal agency that funds primary that funds scientific research at a lot of universities and institutions across the country, requires that investigators demonstrate the intellectual merit, so the good science of their proposed work, but also the broader impacts of their work. In other words, what impact will that work have on society at large? And they're actually held to task in the evaluation of those proposals. And so scientists increasingly are thinking about how might they make an impact, and they're turning to public science outreach in K-12 spaces, outreach in informal science spaces like museums and science centers, as places where they'll be able to connect with those public audiences. And that's one of the really exciting parts of my job as director of public science for the College of Sciences, is to help those faculty think about opportunities and creative ways to make their science accessible, but then also to help, I also get to help them prepare to be successful in that work. I'm not just going to throw them to the wolves per se. I want to make sure that they're going to be good science communicators and that they have the tools in their toolbox to engage the public in effective ways.
So it's one thing to improve communication, certainly, and engage the public in this kind of conversation. But is there a danger that, and again, maybe this is a false dichotomy, but there was always this worry that if you press, or if there are too many incentives for what we would call applied science, in other words, an immediate public benefit, that we sacrifice that long-term basic science that ultimately, but way down the line, leads to applications?
You know, I hear that concern, but I think that there is still plenty of room for discovery-based science and for letting the public have a little bit of insight into that. And in fact, we're working on a plans in the College of Sciences right now in the next year to build a space, a pop-up lab, so the sort of innovative space where groups of faculty, scientists, and graduate students may have residencies where they're doing science sort of in the public sphere. So these will be transparent spaces, all tricked out with lots of communication tools to help bring the public audience, both on our campus and hopefully visitors to campus, to come in and see how that discovery-based science happens.
Let's see what's happening on the campus. The Wolfpack Citizen Science Project. Tell us about that. What's going on?
Yeah, so that was a really exciting collaboration that we had with the NC State Libraries, where we wanted to engage our entire campus community in a citizen science project. We wanted to get them involved in some kind of scientific research. So we partnered with Roland Kays, who is a faculty member in natural resources at NC State, but also works at the Museum of Natural Sciences. And it was a camera trap project. And so we had our participants deploy camera traps that they checked out from the library into wild patches of campus. We have lots of green space, but we're an incredibly urban campus, but with lots of green space. And we really don't know who lives there. And so we had well over 100 participants, lots of teams, deploy their camera traps. These are motion-triggered cameras, and take pictures of the mammals. And the results are still rolling in and being tallied up. But we had lots of sightings of even some surprises.
Such as?
Coyotes, wow. For sure. It wasn't just, I think people assumed that it was going to be all squirrels and maybe some cats. That's some feral cats. And we had deer, squirrels, possums, foxes, and even some coyotes. And this work that happened on campus is contributing to a larger project Roland and his collaborators have that is looking at mammal biodiversity from an urban to rural and wild gradient across the state of North Carolina. And so our work at NC State represents sort of the most urban case for that research.
Do you bring classrooms into this project as well, in terms of allowing them both to contribute, but also also help in the analysis and the follow-up?
Yeah, absolutely. So Roland has a number of students involved in the analysis of that project. There have been some classes that have incorporated that, and we're increasingly looking for ways across campus to put citizen science activities into the curriculum in that way. And so we have the second round of the Wolfpack Citizen Science Challenge we'll be launching in a couple weeks. I actually have a meeting about it this afternoon, and it'll be related to bird biodiversity on campus.
Yeah, well, so you're also a trained entomologist and still involved in a number of ongoing scientific. What are you doing these days?
Oh, man. Well, most of the time I'm doing public science, but I still have my toes dipped a little bit in the waters. And so most of the research projects I'm working on right now are more microbe related. So still analyzing data.
Mine are still there. How are they doing?
I should have contacted my colleague, Julie Horvath at the museum to ask her what's happening.
They must be ready for high school by now.
I'm pretty sure they are. But I've been involved in a project looking at periodical cicadas, and that's really the insect that got me into public science back when I was in graduate school. So working with Deanna Beasley, she's now a faculty member at University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and we're looking at how urbanization, so the spread of concrete jungles may be affecting the health of 17-year periodical cicadas. And so that analysis is ongoing, and we'll have some cicadas emerging in North Carolina this coming summer.
Is this 17-year, the big
birds? These are. Wow. So this isn't—I don't think it's going to be a really giant emergence, but in sort of the Appalachian region of North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, be on the lookout late May, early June.
You don't
June.
Have to be on the lookout.
You'll hear them.
They're on the lookout for you.
You'll hear
Holly,
them.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Holly Menninger is the Director of Public Science for the College of Sciences at North Carolina State University and an entomologist. She is giving a talk called Science Goes Public at the Periodic Tables event Tuesday, January 10th, 7 o'clock, Motor Co. Music Hall in Durham. And, of course, we've got all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.